everybody. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It was funny. A while back, I was, I don't know, maybe texting with Kent, and he had said something, you know, like, hey, when your next book comes out, I want you to come speak at C3. And so I texted him, hey, my next book's coming out. And he said, yeah, I just moved to Georgia. But let me see what I can do. I still have friends there and whatever. And so it was nice of him to make the introduction, and I really appreciate the invitation. Kent and I go way back. We were both involved in each other's last books. I edited his book, Bitten by a Camel. Some of you have probably read that book. And you can ask him, isn't he going to be here in a couple weeks? You can ask him about this, but he was involved in my last book in that when it came out, I was supposed to preach at Mars Hill, and that invitation was rescinded a few days before that happened. And Kent was, you want me to move back because I'm off camera?
Yeah.
Can I move this? Yeah. And so you can ask him about that. I will just say Kent was extremely gracious and beautiful because he's a beautiful human being, and I was going through some hard times, so it was an intense time for both of us, I think, when that happened. Going back before that, I was a very angry young man at age 30, and I was like, I've been on a personal journey that is probably a lot like this faith community has been on, from a more conventional form of church and Christianity to what we're all experiencing now. But at age 30, I was very much a part of that. I had become a pastor, an associate pastor in my home church. I was ordained. I got married. We got a yellow lab. We bought a house. All the things. Right? All the things I was supposed to do. I lived in a nice suburb. Everything on the outside looked great. And on the inside, I was full of turmoil, in large part because the marriage I was in was so toxic. And I take equal amount of blame for that as my former partner. It was a bad deal. But I was not processing that toxicity in healthy ways. I was covering up. I was acting as though everything was great on the outside, because on the outside my life looked so perfect. One of my responsibilities at this big church, which is a big congregationalist church, which I'll come back to, but it's out of the Reformed tradition, similar to a lot of churches around here, I've heard. One of my responsibilities was I was the youth pastor. So I had a monthly meeting with the youth committee. And the youth committee was just sweet parents whose kids were in the youth group. You know, they just like wanted to help plan the confirmation banquet and help raise money for the mission trip, you know, stuff like this. And I don't know, I can't even remember what the issue was, but one, I remember where I was sitting. I remember, it's one of those memories, you know, that's just like burned in me. I remember we were in the youth, in that was called the pond room because it overlooked a pond, and we sat in a circle, and something happened, something triggered me, and I blew up. I just blew up. I start screaming at these parents. I can't even remember what it was about, like the color of the napkins at the confirmation banquet, something totally ridiculous. But obviously, my rage was coming out sideways, and it was wildly inappropriate. And I remember that the chairman of the search committee, it was a guy named Doug, and the vice chair was a woman, a mom named Linda. And I remember they ended the meeting, and they walked me to my car. It was a long walk. It's a huge church and, like, super long walk. And I was just, steam was coming out of my ears, you know. And they were trying to calm me down. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And Doug asked me to breakfast. a couple days later, and I met him for breakfast, and he told me his story, which I hadn't really heard before, that he was a recovering alcoholic, and that he had huge issues with rage, large part rooted in his relationship with his father. And he'd been through an anger management class that was actually taught by somebody at the church. And he recommended that I go through this anger management class. And I don't think it was so much a recommendation as he's the chair of the youth committee. I think it was kind of a requirement. And I did that with a guy, and the guy who taught it is a guy who's still a great friend of mine and ended up being my spiritual director through my divorce. But Doug also asked me if I wanted to go hunting. I'd never been hunting before, and he was a big-time hunter, and I don't even know what prompted him to ask me that. And I said, sure, yeah, I'll go hunting. What do I need, you know? I think my dad has a shotgun I can borrow, and what else do I need? You know, buy some camo, he says, and meet me at my house, and we'll drive. And so I, like, wildly unprepared for this situation, I show up at his house, and he's got these two big black Labrador retrievers and loads them in the minivan and has just so much gear. And I've got, like, I don't know, a jacket, an old camo jacket that I got, and my dad's Remington 870 pump, you know, $300 shotgun. And we get in this van and we start driving, and it turns out we drive all the way from Minneapolis to the border with Canada in Baudette, Minnesota. There's a giant walleye. You pass by. We let the dogs out, they run around, and then we get back in the van and we drive across the International Bridge into Canada, where we have to buy Canadian hunting licenses. We have to buy a remote border crossing permit, so we're allowed to cross on Lake of the Woods, and a remote and some kind of firearms permit in Canada. And then we came back across and started loading up his big boat. And it's starting to dawn on me that this is maybe a little bit bigger endeavor than I expected. This wasn't like we're going to go sit by a pond, boom, 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 and go home, you know. So we load up this 27-foot sport craft big water boat with all sorts of gear. And the next morning we get in it, and he pulls it out of the boathouse, and we go down the Rainy River, and Canada's on our starboard side, and the U.S. is on our port side. Then we pull out into what's called Big Water, which is the biggest part of Lake of the Woods. Lake of the Woods is a massive, massive lake. It's a lake, I mean, just to give you a sense of how massive it is, something like 15,000 islands on Lake of the Woods. And it's super shallow because it was basically a swamp, and there was a dam built in the early 20th century at Kenora, Ontario, that raised the level like 6 feet. So it's a really shallow lake. There's outcroppings everywhere, and there's all these islands. But there's a big part of the lake that we drove through, and we get way up into the Canadian side of Lake of the Woods and pull into a dock, and there I see this red, painted red log cabin sitting on like a granite slab. There in Lake of the Woods, and this is his family's cabin. And we unload everything. I'm like a bit discombobulated by how far away we are from everything. And this is probably like 1999. You know, I think Doug had a bag phone, like a cell phone, you know, in a bag with a strap that he carried and brought out there. I don't even know if it had reception. It was probably just like a placebo that we even had this thing. But there was no GPS or anything. And then he starts explaining how we're going to do this. And there's a couple duck boats on the shore, and we flip them over, and there's all these bags of decoys. And he starts outfitting this duck boat. And he says, we're going to get up at 4 tomorrow morning, get in this little duck boat, and we're going to drive for 2 hours to find exactly the right bay full of wild rice where we're going to be there for opening morning of hunting. And I'm like, what am I going to do? Okay, yeah, whatever, man. Whatever you say. So we get up the next morning, and we get it, and he's got two motors on the back of the boat, two outboard motors, a big one and a small one. They're both like camo, spray-painted camo. And I said, well, why two motors? Are you going to run? And he's like, no, the one's for backup, because where we're going, if one motor fails, like, you have to have redundancy in everything, because there's nobody even knows where we're going. So now I'm starting to get the impression that I'm going farther out into a wild place than I've ever been in my life. And it takes some kind of, it flipped some kind of mental switch in me to be prepared for what we were about to do. And I get in the boat, and the dogs kind of get in on either side of me, and off we go in the pitch dark. And all I can see is it's one of the, you know, there's no street lights, there's no nothing. The canopy of stars is incredible. There's a couple, like, flashing beacons, navigational beacons out in the lake. But other than that, it's just us and the boat. And we go out, and I've got between my legs a car battery and a million candle-watt spotlight. And he shouts at me over the motor. He shouts at me, like, 2 o'clock! And the bow of the boat is 12 noon, and then I have to shine the light wherever he tells me to kind of get bearings of where we are. Once in a while, we hit a rock, you know, and the whole boat goes cattywampus and stuff like this. So, yeah, you can imagine. My heart's in my throat a little bit. And we finally get to this place where he wants to hunt, and we throw out the decoys by the light of this spotlight. And then this is, you know, pre-LED lights and stuff like this. So, and then he takes the boat, and he just, like, and runs it up onto a bog, and we put these stakes in around the boat, and we hang some camo around, and then we sit, and we just sit. And suddenly, it's like pandemonium to absolute calm, absolute peace. And if there's this thing that happens when you're duck hunting and you're waiting for the sun to, you can shoot 30 minutes before sunrise legally. But prior to that, you can hear, you can't see, but you can hear ducks. You can hear, ducks are not very efficient flyers. You can hear their wings whistling. They're flying over you. And then all of a sudden you hear, and they're landing in the decoys. But you have no idea how many have landed in the decoys. But it's this very, very intense experience. And I'm starting to, like, really get into it. And then Doug's looking at his watch, and at the time he's like, okay, now, and we stand up, boom, 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 and we shoot, and ducks flying, and it's crazy, and his dogs are jumping out of the boat and bringing ducks back, and I'm like, this isn't back to pandemonium, you know, this is incredible. And Doug is like a larger-than-life figure, and he's in his largeness in my life is growing by the minute as we're doing this. So we hunt for a couple hours, and then it's okay, the ducks have kind of stopped flying. We're going to go home, take a nap, eat some lunch, and then we're going to go back out for the evening hunt. So we got to go pick up the decoys and whatever. And there are these push poles. We take that's kind of what the canopy was hanging on. And I take these push poles have these, like, retracting duck feet on them, and you stand up in the boat and you push to try to get this duck boat off the bog, and it's not budging. It's not budging. And I should tell you that Doug is like 6'4", 260, okay? College football player who kept eating as though he were a college football player into his 50s or whatever he was at the time. And I cannot move this boat. I'm pushing. You're doing that thing where you try to, like, rock the boat off the bog. It's not working. And all of a sudden I hear splashing in the water, and I turn around, and Doug is completely naked. He took off all his clothes, his waders, his duck boots and everything, climbed over outside the boat, and he's pushing the boat off the bog, all right? And he finally gets it off the bog, and then he rolls in over the gunwale he's on the, splashing around in the water on the bottom of the boat, this enormous human being naked. And I'm just like, what have I gotten myself into? This is complete insanity. Well, I could go on and on about stories about Doug, but I'll just skip ahead. Like, a couple days later, we did the evening hunt where we motored out to a bay and we hunted, and then it got dark, and we're picking up the decoys in the dark by flashlight and stuff, but fog had just really, a huge bank of fog had settled in. And then it started snowing. And then the wind kicked up. And we start going back. And Doug has to run the boat slowly because we can't see anything. He's telling me to shine the spotlight, and he's yelling at me, 2 o'clock, 11 o'clock, or whatever. And I'm trying to shine it, but every island looks the same. And we can barely see anything, but you know that, like, he just wants me to flash the light because he doesn't want to lose his night vision. So I flash the light, and all it is in my retinas, it's just like streaks of snow in the spotlight and fog. We can't see the shore. We hit rocks. We're just going and going, and I'm getting colder and colder. I remember I like pulled my arms out of my sleeves and had them, and these two soaking wet dogs are on either side of me, and there's water splat. You know, we're starting to get big waves, and they're hitting the side of the boat, and some of them are coming over the side of the boat. Doug has this crazy thing where he's running the motor. He'll be running the motor, and then he'll reach down and he'll pull the plug on the back of the boat to drain the water while the boat's going. So I see some nods. That's insane that people do that. That's complete insanity. But he would do that. I'm just like, what if the motor stops and the plug's not in the, you know, anyway. We're going and going. I mean, maybe it's been 2 hours now. And he pulls into a bay and cuts the motor. And he says, I'm lost. I don't know where we are. And we're running low on gas. So at a certain point, if I can't figure out where we are, we're going to pull up onto an island and spend the night with the dogs and just huddle up and wait and hope that the fog burns off in the morning and I can get a bearing and get us back to the cabin. And here's what I remember about that. Is he starts the motor up again and pulls out into the lake, into the waves, into the storm. And I remember getting, like, sitting down off the bench and sitting down on the bottom of the boat with the bench at my back and taking, like, one of those flotation cushions behind me. And I had these two dogs on either side of me. And I remember feeling an extraordinary, overwhelming sense of peace. And this was wild to me. It took me years to figure this out, what was going on. Because I'm in a literal storm, and I'm completely have no control in my situation. I'm 100% reliant upon this larger-than-life guy who's running this boat of getting us out of this predicament. There's no escape for me. I can't control the weather. I have no idea where we are. I can't text somebody for help. I'm completely without resources except my own, whatever inner resources I brought to the situation. And I felt this peace, which was, it took me years to figure this out. It was so at odds with not only that, the external circumstances at the moment, but it was so at odds with everything that was happening for me at home. Where I was a pastor, a very successful pastor at a big church, my first book was about to come out, my career was on the rise, and nothing in my life was peaceful, internally. And at home, it was a disaster. It was nothing but argument and turmoil and rage, which obviously had come out even in my job at this youth committee meeting. And here I am, far away from all that as I could imagine being, where none of that could touch me, and sitting in this boat in a storm, feeling an extraordinary sense of peace. Now, the tragic thing for me is that was at age 30. I spent the next 10 years still trying to do the other thing, still trying to make the other thing work, the family, the career, and all that. And externally, it all was working great. It was, you know, it was all going the right way until, frankly, over about 48 hours in 2015, in the middle of a custody fight, when my last book came out that everything fell apart, including getting that offer rescinded to preach at Mars Hill in Grand Rapids, you know. So I worked really hard for a long time to try to make it work, to manufacture the peace until it all really fell apart, and then I just had to relinquish all that. And as I told the group in pre-talk, what I felt then, 10 years later at age 40, was a pull to the outdoors. That was the place that was going to give me peace, more than the indoors, more than my church experience. And so what I've done in the book and what I've tried to do for myself is figure out what exactly is it about the outdoors life that is so much more kind of where I feel drawn to than where I was previously successful in the church world. And here's one thing that has occurred to me, is that when I think about the church I served, which was, like I said, a church in the Reformed tradition, similar to probably some of the churches that some of you came from, similar even to the church this C3 used to be, right? Everything was at right angles. Our sanctuary, we called it a meeting house in the Congregationalist fashion, but I can imagine it in my mind's eye. Everything's at right angles. It's got the perfect center aisle. You know, it's got the pulpit. We wore the Geneva gowns every Sunday. Everything had to be regular. You know, there's a line in the Presbyterian Book of Worship says that worship should be done decently and in order. And Presbyterian ministers, ha ha ha, joke, isn't that funny? But of course, that is exactly what those liturgies are like. They're supposed to be orderly every single week. So every week, we did it the exact same way at my church, at Colonial Church. Everything was regularized. Everything was at right angles. As I said at pre-talk, if the service went over 58 minutes, we got a real talking to at staff meeting on Tuesday. I told one funny story. I'll tell a different one about, I have this vivid memory of, I was an associate pastor. We weren't wearing these headset mics yet. We had lavalier mics clipped onto our robes, okay? So I'm behind the communion table with the senior minister, and we're doing the words of institution and whatever, and there was this kind of funny, crazy lady in the congregation named Kathy who, she was very melodramatic. Every congregation has them, you know, and she was one of those crazy ladies. I loved her. I went on mission trips with her to Peru, but she worked for World Vision. She was always going over all around the world and coming back with crazy ailments, always. And so I think at the time she had yellow fever or I don't know what she had, dengue fever. She had something. She always had something. So we're like doing the work. Just imagine the scene. Like, here's this table, and you know, I don't know, that sanctuary seats 950. So there must have been at least 500 people in the room at the time. And so we've got all the loaves of bread and all the cups, and we're doing the this and the this, you know, and whatever. And the deacons are all sitting in the front on the front pew because they're going to come up and take them and then go serve and pass them down the rows. And Kathy comes in down the center aisle. She'd like, I don't know, gone to the restroom or whatever. She was sitting in the second because she always sat very close to the front. She gets up to go to the restroom or something, and she makes this big melodramatic thing and passes out in the middle aisle. And I'm like, you know, I'm the 30-year-old youth pastor, and the senior minister, David, I'll never forget, he puts his hand over his lavalier mic, and he doesn't make eye contact with me, he just puts his hand over his lavalier mic and says, just keep going. not kidding. So I did, you know, and the body of Christ is working for you. And there are ushers coming down and helping Kathy, you know, getting her out to the deal. And this is just like, this is not real life. This is not real life. We sat in staff meetings, and I remember the church administrator, Karen, she's like, look, we have to talk. What do we have to talk about? The AA group on Thursday night, they are not cleaning the urns, the coffee urns, and we have laminated policies in the kitchen on how to clean the urns, the coffee urns. Can we still have AA if they don't clean the... I'm just like, oh my God, I'm going mental. This doesn't make any sense. And this is one of the funny things that Kent and I have joked about over the years, because, of course, he had similar experiences of being on a big church staff. My life was a mess. When I went into the woods are a mess. There are no right angles in the wilderness. Everything is twisted and broken. Trees, just take a walk. You don't even have to be like me and be a hunter and take a gun. Just take a walk in the woods. And what do you see? Dead trees on the ground, crumpled over each other, that did not survive the last windstorm. But look more closely, and what do you see? Moss, bugs, little sprouts of new trees growing in the compost and humus of the dead tree. And there's thorns trying to reach out and scratch you, and there's stumps for you to break your toe on. And then suddenly you pass what? A picked, clean rib cage of a deer. Death, right there, in the wild. But that death, of course, that deer was picked clean by a bunch of critters. There's a researcher at the University of Minnesota, and she's been for years doing an awful project, OFFAL. And there's a lot of, you know, jokes about that. And that is after you kill your deer and you field dress it, which is meaning you take the guts out of the deer and you leave a gut pile in the woods. You put up a trail camera and it takes pictures for the next month of every critter that comes and eats off that gut pile. And so I've done this with her, and she makes all this. This is all part of her PhD or whatever. And it's crazy. I mean, you can imagine the critters that come, the crows. It's crows and mice and turkey vultures and bald eagles and bears and all sorts of critters come. And it's all part of this cyclical process, of course. So for me, what I decided I was going to do when I went through the disaster that was my personal life, that ended up being a divorce and a custody fight and losing my career and getting foreclosed on and all the bad things from that kind of external material sense, was that I was just going to be more honest about what my life was really like. And being in nature, being in wild places, to me, that was a much more honest reflection of the reality of my inner life than the right angles and regularized decently in order liturgies of the church world. Nothing, again, and I'm sure you all, you know, probably still have family members and friends who go to those, and I'm not condemning anybody who goes to those kind of churches. It just doesn't work for me anymore because it wasn't an accurate reflection of what life is really like. So the book and my own journey has been a journey out of church and into the woods and in pursuit of whatever we may call it. I know I've been told some people have a struggle with the word God, and I think, I mean, that's what got Kent fired from Mars Hill, was saying, I don't know what the word God means anymore some days. You know, that was a bridge too far. But luckily, it's so great that there are communities like this where it's safe to say things like that, to ask those questions, and to confront the reality of death, because I'll leave you with this as we talked about in the pre-talk. In the tradition of the Stoic philosophers, they had a value on what's called memento mori. That is a Latin phrase meaning remember your death. Remember your mortality. Keep your mortality ever in front of you because that will lead you to live a better life. It wasn't, you know, sometimes the Stoics, people are like, oh, you're such a Stoic. You know, people throw that around. Or my grandpa, the Stoic Norwegian, or something like that. But the actual tradition of Stoicism is a very vibrant philosophical tradition in which we are to, as I said in the pre-talk, it's like when you think about the some Renaissance painting you saw in a museum, and it's a still life that's, some fruit and a vase of flowers and a brace of pheasants hanging from a shelf, and then a skull. And maybe you were like, what's the skull doing there? Everything else is, you know, the skull, that's the memento mori. That's the reminder of mortality always before you. Because when we go to places and when we have conversations with people and, frankly, when we're in spiritual communities that have honest conversations about our mortality, it, at least the Stoics taught, it provokes us to live better, more fulfilled, more loving lives. Thanks for having me.